Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dablina Chakraborty.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And the story we're about to tell happened in Atlanta, actually, kind of in our own backyards, but we don't feel too self-conscious about telling it because this topic has been requested many times by listeners, and that's not surprising. The Leo Frank trial has been called, quote, one of the most shocking frame-ups ever perpetuated by American law and order officials. And the story involves a Jewish man named Leo Frank being convicted, many think wrongly convicted, for the murder of a young girl named Mary Fagan, and a group of men taking the law into their own hands and trying to make sure that basically he paid the ultimate price for this. But there was much more to this story than just these acts and who was guilty or not guilty. This was a situation about industrialism and the injustices associated with it, race relations, North-South tensions, so a lot of things. So it's no wonder that it caught the attention and kind of the emotions of the entire nation.
But it's still a mystery, too, in a way. To this day, people still wonder what really happened to Mary Fagan. So we're going to take a look at the crime, the evidence, the trial that ensued. But first, we're going to try to talk a little bit about the man that ended up at the center of all this controversy, Leo Frank.
Leo Max Frank was born in Paris, Texas in 1884, but his family moved to Brooklyn, New York when he was very small, and he grew up there. He went to public school, the Pratt Institute, and since he was very mechanically minded, he got an engineering degree from Cornell University. Now, he worked for a brief time with a few different companies, but eventually he joined the family business. He went to work for his uncle, Moses Frank, who was the principal owner of the National Pencil Company. And that company had a factory in Atlanta, and in 1907, Frank was made co-owner and superintendent of that location of that factory and moved down south.
So in 1910, he married a native Atlantan, Lucille Selig, who came from a prominent Jewish family. And by 1913, he'd been honored by the local Jewish community as one of Atlanta's most promising young businessmen. So he looked like he had a great future ahead of him. And Atlanta's Jewish community wasn't as big as New York's, of course, but it was still fairly significant. And it was significant enough that Frank probably didn't feel very isolated. He didn't worry that much about racism. He spent most of his time working, so he seemed to be leading a fairly successful, definitely peaceful life.
Yes, but all of that changed April 26th, 1913.
That's when Mary Fagan, who was this strikingly beautiful blonde 13-year-old girl from Marietta, Georgia, so just outside the city, she stopped by the factory to get her pay on the way to a Confederate Memorial Day parade. And around this time, the state's economy was really undergoing a kind of change. It was going from a more agrarian economy to more of an industrial economy. So Frank's factory, like many others, employed women and children to perform light labor tasks because they could be paid lower wages than men. So we're talking like $5 or $6 a week is what they were taking home.
So it saved the factory some money. And Mary was, of course, one of these workers. And she was even making less than that at the time because she was part of a temporary layoff. So she had only worked one day for that entire week and was picking up $1.20. So Mary was, of course, one of these low paid workers. And she was even making less than $5 or $6 a week at the time because she was part of a temporary layoff. So she had only worked one day that week and was only picking up $1.20. So she stopped by Frank's office that Saturday. And according to his story, she got her money, he paid the bill, and she left. And she was never seen alive again.
Around 3 a.m. the next day, the night watchman, Newt Lee, was on his way to the Negro toilet, which was located in the factory basement. And that's where he found the body of a girl near the bottom of an elevator shaft. She was so completely covered in sawdust and grime that at first it was hard to even tell if she was white or black. Her skull was dented and caked in blood. Her eyes were bruised and her cheeks were cut and a cord was wrapped around her neck. So at this point, Lee calls the police. He's afraid they'll suspect him, and they come in to inspect the scene. And with the help of another worker, they identify the body as Mary Fagan. They arrested Lee right away, so his worries were correct, and incidentally, he was held without charges for months after that. But then the police went to get Frank. They wanted to take him along to see the body and question him at the site. And it was an experience that Frank did not handle smoothly, as we'll see later. He was disturbed by the sight of the body, and he seemed really nervous to them. So that was kind of the beginning of his problems. And they questioned him for a long time and then formally arrested him on April 29th, 1913.
But things were moving along at quite a clip with this investigation because police were under a lot of pressure to find and convict a killer. And there had been a series of unsolved murders in Atlanta during the previous year and a half. So the city was really frustrated with the police, and they wanted justice. And Mary Fagan ended up becoming a kind of symbol for them. Initial reports even said that she had been raped. That made people even more outraged. So officials moved quickly to assemble whatever clues they could that would prove Frank's guilt. And this is what they came up with at first. They thought, well, he was really nervous the day after the murder, and that seems suspicious. They were also suspicious by the fact that he had called Lee several times that night to see if there was any trouble, and that was something that he normally did not do. And then finally, the fact that several employees came forward and said that Frank, quote, indulged in familiarities with a woman in his employ. And a woman who ran a boarding house even claimed that Frank had called her the day of the murder, trying to arrange a room for himself and a young girl. So this is what police were initially acting on.
On that last point in particular, many of the witnesses, including the boarding house proprietress, they later recanted their accusations. But these same accusations helped Hugh Dorsey, who was a prosecutor with pretty big political ambitions, to build a case around Frank as this Jewish man who was preying on Gentile girls for his own pleasure. 4 weeks later, a grand jury used this information to indict Frank.
But there were some more clues that came in, clues that seem a little more promising than the ones we already went over, real clues that seemed to be all but ignored ultimately. There were these two strange notes that were scribbled on scraps of yellow paper, and they were found near the body. And they're kind of tricky to read here, but one of them said, "Ma'am, that Negro hire down here did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro black, that who it was, long, slim, tall Negro, I write while play with me." And the other note, also written in this kind of difficult to follow style, said he would love me, land, dab, and play like the night witch did it, but that long, tall black Negro did by himself. So these unusual notes found near the body seem like a major major new clue.
Yeah, and obviously they're confusing because they contain some bad spelling and things like that and are hard to read, as Sarah said, but they're also contradictory. I mean, the first one sort of seems to identify the murderer, and the second kind of suggests that the writer was saying he was trying to throw suspicion elsewhere. So it was very confusing, but it's at least something that seems like it should have been pursued.
The next piece of evidence was also found near the body at the bottom of the elevator shaft. It was human excrement. And we're going to get into that a little more later because there are a few other clues involving that. But the likely owner of said human excrement was a black janitor named Jim Conley. And he had been seen washing blood out of a shirt at the factory after the murder. So, whoa, that sounds like there is a whole nother potential suspect involved here.
Yes, in fact, there was another suspect. Conley was working at the factory the day of the murder and even admitted to have written those two notes when police arrested and questioned him on the matter. But he claimed that Frank had dictated the notes to him.
So, throwing a wrench in this whole thing.
Right, and according to Leonard Dinnerstein in American Heritage, the grand jury wanted to reconvene and actually charge Conley instead. But perhaps because of these political aspirations of Dorsey's, and he actually became governor later, we should throw that in there too.
The aspirations paid off.
They did pay off, but he wouldn't allow this. He wouldn't allow them to reconsider this. We're not really sure how he talked them out of it, but Dinnerstein suggests that, quote, given Southern values, they may have assumed that no attorney would base his case on the word of a black man unless the evidence was overwhelming.
So basically the grand jury just felt persuaded by Dorsey's dedication to this case. He was just so sure that Leo Frank was guilty that he was willing to believe even Jim Conley.
But regardless of how he did it, Dorsey did win out, and the trial started July 28, 1913 in Atlanta. A large angry mob showed up in attendance, and they were shouting things like, hang the Jew, and they weren't just saying that outside the doors of the courthouse. They were saying things like that in the courtroom.
So,
yeah, it was a really intimidating atmosphere to be in. And you have to wonder how in this environment they could have chosen an unbiased jury. I mean, they did choose a jury.
Or how an unbiased juror would remain unbiased.
True. I mean, there were so many tensions going on in this scenario at the time. There were class tensions. It was working class versus a factory owner. Race, you know, there was anti-Semitism going on. North versus South, since Frank was technically a Yankee, and that rubbed people the wrong way. So things seemed to be working in Dorsey's favor almost, and he presented his case. He proposed that Frank killed Fagan in a workroom outside his office on the second floor, and that the body was dragged to an elevator and taken to the basement. His argument included witness testimony that there were blood spots on the floor there and hair on a lathe, but it didn't really make sense. There were a lot of holes in this approach. Here's just an example of a few things. For example, a state biologist had concluded that the hair that was found on that lathe wasn't actually Fagan's. Witnesses also said that those blood spots found on the floor could have actually been paint. And the excrement that Sarah mentioned earlier would have had to have been mashed when the elevator went down. I mean, every time that the elevator went down, it completely hit
smushed
the bottom
everything
of the floor.
At the bottom.
Right. But apparently, it wasn't until after the body was discovered that actually occurred, that the excrement was smashed and they smelled that telltale smell. However, Conley had said that he deposited said excrement there before the murder, so it didn't add up.
But the prosecution's case really revolved around Conley's testimony almost entirely. Interestingly, though, he had changed his story several times before the trial. He had even signed four different affidavits. But once he got in there, once he got up on the stand, he stuck to his account. He didn't waver. It's very likely that he was coached to give this strong story in front of the court, but he claimed that Frank summoned him to his office that day, and here's what he had to say. His eyes were large and they looked right funny, and then confessed the crime. And Conley said that Frank offered but never gave him money to dispose of the body, and asked Conley if he could write, and once Conley said he could, Frank dictated the murder notes. So Frank, meanwhile, had two well-known attorneys acting in his defense, Luther Z. Rosser and Reuben R. Arnold. And most feel that what really hurt their defense is that they weren't able to make a dent in Conley's testimony. They couldn't shake him. He just completely stuck to that story. even though he had changed it quite a bit before getting into court. And even though Frank had strong character witnesses, too, and alibis, people to account for his whereabouts before, during, and after the murder, the jury still found him guilty on September 26, 1913. And they took less than 4 hours, actually, to deliberate what had been one of the longest trials in Georgia history. So essentially, their minds were made up.
And as a result of that, Frank was sentenced to be executed on October 10th of that year, but the execution was stayed by several ultimately unsuccessful appeals on the part of his lawyers. So they made a couple of appeals to the Georgia Supreme Court. One upheld the conviction on February 17th, 1914, and another one did the same on October 14th, 1914. His defense lawyers then made a habeas corpus petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the court ended up denying that petition, despite the fact that there were some strong dissents to it. I mean, Justices Oliver Wendell Holmes and Charles Evans among them. So there were some people who were in favor of that petition. And while all this legal stuff was going on, there were some kind of crazy developments, including witnesses taking back those accusations. We mentioned that earlier, the accusations about Frank's alleged sexual deviations. And also Conley's girlfriend came into the picture. She came into the picture and gave some testimony about Conley's own sexual perversion, so to speak. And Conley's own lawyer told Judge Roan, who had been the trial judge, that Conley had confessed the murder to him.
So that seems like a pretty damning new piece of evidence, I would say, if there's an actual confession. But
that had actually come to light during the appeals process. So we should mention that. It didn't really make a difference
trial,
in his appeals.
He would have had to get a retrial or something for that to have an effect. But the last appeal, the final appeal, was made to Governor John M. Slayton, whose term was almost up by this point. And he listened to both sides. He studied the records. He visited the scene. And he also considered all these new things that we've mentioned. And after struggling with it for 12 days, so it wasn't going to take him 4 hours, 12 days of thinking it over, Slayton commuted Frank's sentence to life imprisonment on June 21st, 1915. And he knew how serious that decision was. He told his wife, "It may mean my death or worse, but I've ordered the sentence commuted." And as he suspected, it was a very unpopular decision. There were demonstrations about it. Vandalism took place against Jewish homes and stores around the city. And Frank had been moved already by this point to a prison at Milledgeville, which was supposedly more secure, except that after Slayton's reversal of the decision, it didn't prove secure at all.
No, while he was there, an inmate cut Frank's throat, and they were able to save him. But while he was recovering on August 16th, 1915, a group of 25 vigilantes from Marietta drove out to the prison, overpowered the guards, and took Frank with them back to Marietta, which was a pretty long drive. So they took him back to where Mary Fagan was from. And there, a lynch mob watched as they hung him from an oak tree. And all this time, during the drive back and before they hung him, they truly tried to get him to confess, but he never did. He just asked for his wedding ring to be sent to his wife.
So after the lynching, locals knew the identities of the men involved, but they were never prosecuted. And the men who did it even sort of used it as a rallying cry, as a point of pride. They called themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan. And the girl's name just alone became a rallying cry for the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the area. It was something that people still dwelled on, even a few years after.
Yeah, a few years after, and some people still debate about this up until today. I mean, they still debate over whether Frank was actually guilty or innocent. Many historians seem to believe in his innocence, and frankly, I mean, if you look at a lot of sources for material about this case, they seem to lean that way, that he was wrongly accused. In 1982, an old black man named Alonzo Mann, who worked at Frank's factory as a child, came forward and said that he'd seen Conley drag Mary Fagan's corpse to the basement, but he kept silent about it because Conley at the time had threatened to kill him. him. And I think he even went to his mom and told her what had happened, and she was like, don't get involved. So this didn't come to light until the 80s. And on March 11th, 1986, the Georgia State Board of Pardon and Paroles posthumously pardoned Frank. But as Dinnerstein's piece points out, this doesn't exactly exonerate him for the crime. It was granted, quote, in recognition of the state's failure to protect the person of Leo Frank and thereby preserve his opportunity of continued legal appeal of his conviction, and in recognition of the state's failure to bring his killers to justice, and as an effort to heal old wounds. So it was basically to give him back his civil rights, in a sense.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting to talk about this case because it is so often suggested to us, so I guess a lot of people do know about it, but for a podcast called Stuff You Missed in History Class, this is something that I have had in almost every history class. I mean, from Georgia history in middle school to high school U.S. history to college, it's really heavily taught here in Georgia.
And I hadn't learned anything about it growing up.
Oh, in another state. So maybe it is something that Georgia and Georgians are especially concerned with studying and make sure we don't forget this, certainly this crime against somebody's civil liberties. But I'm curious to hear from some of you whether it's something that you learned, if you're from Georgia, whether you learned in history, or if you are from another state or from another country, whether you got taught this case.
Yeah, and I'm interested to really hear what people think about whether Leo Frank was innocent or guilty. I know that some people still have really passionate opinions about it. I was looking up the recent film, I think it was from 2009, called The People versus Leo Frank. And if you just, do a regular search for it, all these articles come up and just people really passionately talking about how they think it might be slanted or, just voicing their opinions on the matter. So I'd be interested to hear what people think.
And since we'll hit the 100th anniversary in just a few years, I'm sure it's going to be in the news even more. But since we are interested in what you think, we're going to go to some listener mail now. So we have three pieces of real mail today. And one, since we're talking about classes and what you actually learn in history class, I thought I would mention this postcard we got of Lyons, New York, the Peppermint Village, from Eric. And he wrote to tell us how much his sixth grade class loves the show. So I was glad to hear that. And
very cool.
Maybe this is something that they'll be learning in a few years. We got another postcard of some kiddies in Key West and a suggestion from Sonia to cover the very unusual, kind of amazing history of Key West. I don't know, Hemingway maybe? That might be fun. And finally, we got a whole range of items from listener Lauren. She had visited Cahokia after hearing about the podcast. She and her boyfriend went by there and picked up all sorts of stuff. So I feel like I've kind of gone to Cahokia myself now. She sent a postcard of Monk's Mound. She sent the tour guide, the English version. Thanks for including that one. That's probably easiest. So we can learn a little more about Cahokia. And best of all, she sent us a patch that has the little Cahokia figure, the guy who's so associated with the mounds. It has Monk's Mound, and it has a few other symbols. And this is the second history class patch we've gotten. We got one for Tecumseh, too.
Oh, my gosh. You know what this means.
Like a badge time, like we need to get sashes and iron these on.
Sashes, that's an even better idea. I was going to say
Scout
vests,
style.
But yeah.
Oh, yeah, vests. Well, maybe Dublina and I will have to go visit like a thrift store and look for some cast-off Girl Scout wear and apply our patches and start wearing them proudly. In the meantime, I can display it in my cube.
Yeah, maybe we'll take some photos for Facebook.
So yeah, if you have postcards, we love getting them. If you have patches, we could try to start a collection here.
That's true. You don't have to send a patch.
No.
But we do like them.
And just a plain old email is fine, too. We're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Twitter at Missed in History, and we are on Facebook. So you can let us know about what you learned in history class, give us suggestions, or just write to say hi.
And if you were intrigued by the content of this episode and you want to see a little more like it, we have an article on our website called 10 Controversial Court Cases, and you can look it up by visiting our homepage and typing in controversial court cases at www.howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.